Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order the 9th of February, Monday, 2026. With me today is Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Teal, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, and myself, Stedman. We have a full contingent today. We're going to have to be done a few minutes early, like maybe 20 minutes early, because we've got another meeting we've been summoned to. So today we're going to have the Public Employees Retirement System, better known as PERS, and the Teachers Retirement System, TERS, update. Presenting today is Christopher Novell. He's the Chief Financial Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefits in person. If he can come forward, is he out there somewhere? Melinda Voigt, Chief Pension Officer, Division of Retirement and Benefits in person. And then we have Chris Murray, Acting Chief Health Administrator, Division of Retirement and Benefits telephonically, and also available online for actuary questions is David Kirshner, Principal Consulting Actuarial, Gallagher Benefits. And this isn't the issue concerning defined benefit, defined contribution subject matter, but it's the status of our current retirement program and programs. So if you can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then take us through your presentation. We will go one slide at a time as our normal process, so you can finish your thought process on that particular slide. We'll have questions from members, and then we'll go to the next slide, and I'll watch the clock, and we'll try to be done on time. Okay. Go ahead.
So thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Christopher Novell. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. I'm with me.
For the record, my name is Mindy Voigt. I am the Chief Pension Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits.
Okay, so the planned format of our presentation is for me to spend some time speaking to the PERS and TERS funds. Chris Murray, who is online, will be spending a little time on the health funds. And lastly, I'm going to talk a bit about the e-reporting outage that occurred in November 24 and the restoration efforts which went into July 2025. So this first slide outlines the organization of for PERS and TERS. So the first column is the Department of Revenue, the Treasury Division. This division handles investments for the defined benefit plans and helps determine the investments for the defined contribution plans and where members can put their funds. They are also staffed to the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and they also have internal and external investment management teams. The middle entity is the Alaska Retirement Management Board. They are charged with a fiduciary duty of the pension plans and to set contribution rates. They invest all retirement system assets, including health insurance. They're also assisted by an investment advisory committee, and they also have a secondary or a reviewing actuary called GRS. And lastly, the Department of Administration is the home for us, the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Our fiduciary is the commissioner for the Department of Administration, who is by statute the plan sponsor. We administer the retirement benefits and health benefits. We hold the contract with the primary valuation actuary, Gallagher. We also have several third-party administrators who we work with for the retiree health plans and for record keeping. And we also conduct employer audits to ensure our PERS-TERS employers are compliant in the administration of the payroll systems as relates to our retirement systems.
We probably want to pick the pace up here.
Okay. So the first slide is relating to the membership of PERS and TERS. As you can see on this slide, we have a grand total of, across all the statuses, of 105,471. The active participation split between defined benefit and defined contribution for PERS and TERS is 21%, 79%, which is an increase or movement of 2% on last year. So slide four speaks to the investment experience. The FY25 valuation is still in draft form to be officially submitted to the Alaska Retirement Management Board in March this year. The assumed actual earnings rate has remained at 7.25% since 2022 for PERS and TERS. Basing earnings on the fair or market value of assets for 2025, we see PERS and TERS at 10.8% and 10.9% respectively. The last row shows that the valuation, the actuarial valuation of assets, which the draft valuation puts at 9.3% for PERS and TERS. This valuation uses a five-year smoothing method with the intent of eliminating any market volatility.
So if you can just briefly explain why you do a smoothing and what it is so we can remind the
Through the chairs. So the smoothing is our actuaries take the gains and losses of the last 5 years, 2024, and we just recognize 20% of those gains. So the idea of that is to smooth out any peaks and troughs in the market.
And then if you could talk a little bit about your FY, your 25 draft. Is that calendar year, fiscal year, or a delay? And
The years there are fiscal years.
Okay. Go ahead, next slide.
So the next slide, we're taking a look at the funding status of our pensions. The PERS pension liability for 2025, again in draft form, stands at $17.3 billion, and the actuarial valuation of assets is at $12.2 billion, which leaves the PERS defined benefit fund at $5.1 billion unfunded or 70.3% funded. The TERS liability for 2025, again in draft form, stands at $8.1 billion with the AVA is $6.4 billion, which leaves the TERS defined benefits at $1.6 billion or 79.8% funded. The pattern across the last few years shows both funds increasing their funding ratio.
And how does it look if we go back 10 years? Have that roughly, or what our liability was, say, if we go back 10 years?
To the chair, there is a slide a little bit later on which shows the history of the funding ratios, and it's do you want me to forward to that?
Or wait till we'll come back to that, because the concern that some of us have is the amount of money being spent to deal with our unfunded liability versus the decline in that liability, because since 2015, the liability has increased $294 million, and we spent $2 billion to do it. So there is a concern with that issue. So we'll cover that in your later slides, if you would like.
To the chair, is there a detailed slide on that coming up?
Okay.
So slide six speaks to the funding status of the healthcare. Here we have the opposite story, where the negatives on line C and F show the healthcare to be overfunded, with a funded ratio of 132.1% AVA on PERS, and TERS, the AVA, is 140.6%. Any questions on that?
Was that good or bad?
To the chair, an overfunded any underfunding presents its own challenges. Regarding healthcare funds, the overfunding is largely regarded by the EGWP, the Employee Group Waiver Program, and at any time that could be removed and would bring our funding status closer to 100%. So
there is some risk that you'll go over later on when you get into that subject of that this overfunding could be eliminated or declined substantially?
There are some more projections going through this presentation on the funding status for the healthcare and the risks associated with it.
Okay. And then touch on why we can't just take this overfunding and apply it to the underfunding of the pension.
They're completely separate funds, and there are statutes which say we can't do that. I'll have to get back onto you what those are.
Okay. Short answer is you don't want to go to jail.
To the chair, I do not.
Okay, that sounds good.
Okay. So the graph on slide 7 shows the funding status for the PERS pension and healthcare. Side by side, just as Senator Stedman pointed out, the pension and healthcare funds are completely separate and cannot be used to offset each other. So this side-by-side chart is just for visual information purposes only. But proceeding with that caveat, this chart shows the PERS pension in blue and healthcare in orange. And as you can see, the PERS pension is below 80%, whereas healthcare is over 130%, consistent with the data I presented on the earlier slide.
So on this slide, just for history for those watching, back in 2006 when the new tiers were put in, the concentration of dealing with the funding status, we were worried about the pension. The health care, not so much the pension. The health care being the funding ratio shown here at that long, right over 40%. So that was a significant concern. We thought that the pension, you know, would be more easily worked out, and as we went forward, but it turned out that our most conservative estimate, conservative meaning everything goes to hell in a handbasket, was far too optimistic, which is kind of shocking as we look back 20 years, because the problematic child here turned out to be the pension plan, and we were able to fix the health care. So that is just some history of what we dealt with. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you to the chair. So what we're looking at here is a closed system. There's not additional units of demand in terms of people coming into the system. So the from 2006 onwards, it's essentially a closed system.
Correct, but you can't. Correct, it's a closed system, but the current employees don't pay for the unfunded liability. So, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Novell, maybe you could help us, because prior to, I think, 15 or maybe it was 17, we didn't account separately for our assets and health and pension, right? So can you tell us how you reconstructed funded ratios going back before the GASB statements had started requiring that? We always accounted for them. Other states didn't. But we always accounted for our liabilities, but we didn't separately account our assets. So how did we go back and apply create these funded ratios?
To the chair, to Senator Keel, if I'm correct, you're referring to our prior actuaries, Mercer, who did combine the two assets. And in answer to your question, our current actuaries, through other data, estimated going back prior to, I think, 2014, 2015, like you said.
We'll move on.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Yep. So slide 8 is TERS telling the same story as PERS, an overfunded health care fund and an underfunded pension fund. So this slide, slide 9 we're on, the next two slides show the correlation between the actual rate of return and the funded ratio. For ease of viewing, I've put the font bold, where the funded ratio has increased in the prior year. So this slide is for the PERS pension only. The right three columns show the assets and liabilities over the last 25 years. Since 2000, our assumed actual earnings rate has changed on three occasions, most recently in 2022 to 7.25. The 30-year average is shown on the last line. So also in analysing this data, it's important to consider the impact of the $3 billion infusion in 2015 when looking to the funded ratio.
You want to touch on the $3 billion funding? Break that down, if you would, please.
To the chair, I don't have that data with me yet. There was a
we put $1 billion in the pension, PERS, and we put $2 billion in TERS. That included that current year's contribution, so it wasn't like if you take PERS, it wasn't a billion extra. It was $1 billion total. So there was the normal funding that would have taken place, but it did make a difference, obviously to control the liability growth. That was done here at the finance table. So, and then talk a little bit about funding ratios. Can you give us an idea on that? And then for those watching at home, is there any reason they should be concerned about not getting a check?
To the chair, to your earlier question regarding the actuarial funding ratios, the purpose of this is to show us side by side against the actuarial rate of returns and what pattern there is. And I think to your second question relating to the strength of the funds, if we look at it from a risk point of view. Currently just looking at PERS at 70.3%. If everyone was to retire at this point, we could look after 70.3% of them, or another way to look at that, if 70.3% retired, we could take care of them. So that's
so
the situation
no,
of the risk.
Right, so the point being for those watching at home, even back in 2013 when we were at a 54% funding ratio, there's zero probability of them not getting a check. There's ample liquidity within our retirement plan, has always been there. We've struggled with, for the last 20 years, retiring the unfunded liability. But folks that are retired and are going into retirement have no reason to be concerned that there's any delay in receiving their benefits because there's ample funds available. We'll work at the table here to retire that unfunded liability, but that's a separate issue. And it's also in the event that there was some catastrophic liquidation, their benefits are backed up by the Constitution, a requirement, and the full faith and credit of the state, which is taxing authority in the permanent fund. So there is zero probability of it ever happening. And 70% funding ratio is a lot more comfortable than a 54%. And I would also like to note that 103 in the beginning and 102 for PERS. The reason those funding levels look so high is they were misstated. And when we redid the plans, we never went back and had our accounts restated like you would if you're a corporation and you needed to restate your earnings. So we figured it'd be just a waste of time and money. But in retrospect, maybe we should have done that because people will look at this and think it was a one-year decline, and that I don't think is accurate at all. It was underfunded back in 2000 and 2001. We had funky data. So the 86.8 is a much more accurate reflection of where we were at the time. A little bit of history for those of us that have unfortunately been dealing with this for two decades. Go ahead and continue.
So slide 10 is providing the same data relating to the TERS fund. And as you can see, as we look towards the bottom, 24 and 25, we're seeing an increase in the actuarial funded ratio moving towards the 80% mark.
So the other point I'd like to make is when we look at both the TERS and the PERS, and we look at our assumed actuarial earnings rate, which is our targeted future rate of return, we've expressed concern at this table many, many times over the years that the rates were too high when they were 7 or 8 1/4. And even when they turned to 8, the markets were deteriorating looking forward, and we were expressing a concern that there was a delay. They should have been lowered. And then they moved them to 7.38, and now we're down to 7 1/4. And financial markets change as the economy changes. But many, many times we've had presentations here with in the past where they've had, like back in 08 or 07, 06, pick your dates, 12, 13, when they've taken those targeted rates of return and shot the portfolio forward at those that growth rates, and we never hit them. And you have it recalculated a couple years later, and we never hit them. And a couple years later, and we never hit them. And we've asked for those charts to be submitted to the committee several times. I think we should have that redone so they can take the portfolio that we have and grow it at 7 1/4% with other adjustments and see if we hit that 7 1/4 targeted rate. I don't know if we're going to hit it or not. Last year, obviously, we did. It's showing here at 10.12, which is good. And I think for the current calendar year ending in 25, the retirement portfolios returned about 13%. So that's good. And I would like to thank, while we're getting into this, I would like to thank the department for doing a good job on administering the assets. We're going to get into that in a little later in another meeting, but the performance has been really good. We see it in our SBS accounts, supplemental benefit accounts, our deferred compensation accounts, and the defined contribution accounts, and we'll also be looking at the defined benefit rate of return on that portfolio relative to everybody else. But the department has done a very good job, and I'd just like to thank the department because they don't get enough accolades for the hard work and performance they actually do. So I don't want to, you know, the questions that come down the table are not derogatory at all to the department. They're actually doing a good job, and we should thank them for it. And we just need to make another $6 billion, and we're out of the hole. But go ahead and continue.
Okay, to the chair, we appreciate that. So moving on to slide 11, we've got the unfunded actuarial liability for PERS. This is showing it in dollars rather than as a percentage of funded ratio since 2006. Pension fund in blue, healthcare in orange. Underwater is underfunded, and as you can see from 2018 onwards, healthcare moved from an under to an overfunded situation. The pension fund has remained relatively flat and has been hovering around about $5 billion unfunded since 2018.
So if we take a look, the point I want to bring to the table, not a fun point, but if you look at 2015, at the end of 2015, that's after we put in the $1 billion, we're at $4.4 billion in liability. That's, again, at 2015. Now we're at 2025, we're at $5.1 billion, and I think the current number I have for FY25 is pretty close to that here, a little over $5 billion. So we went from $4 billion to negative $5 billion. And in that time, we've added $2 billion in funding. So that's a concern that we're not retiring that debt. At least I think we need to recognize we're not retiring that debt, and it costs money, of course, as quick as some of us would like. So that is a concern. And anyway, I just want to point that out to the committee members that we'll be working on that subject. And we see it in the upcoming operating budget submission. The ARM board has asked for one level of funding on dealing with some amortization. The administration suggested a lower number of funding, and we need to have that in the table and talk about that and decide what we want to recommend. Go ahead and continue.
So moving on to slide 12, this is telling more or less the same story for the TERS retirement system.
Well, let's stop there because it's so much fun that I can't help but slow down. After $2 billion of funding in TERS in 2015, we took the liability from $3 billion down to $1 billion. In 25, we're at $1 billion. So for a decade, we worked very hard not to sink the ship, but I think we put in another $1.2 billion or some number into this. We can refine that number, but we're in the same spot. So we need to recognize that. Even though the funding ratio has improved, let's not forget that. Things are getting better in the funding ratio because the portfolio is growing in dollars relative, you know, to the liability in percentages, but the dollar unfunded liability still needs to be serviced, and it's still at the same amount as it was in 2015.
Shall I proceed?
Yes, go ahead.
So here we are on slide 13, and this shows a history of the legislative bills towards the additional state contributions from 2006 through 2026, and this includes the $3 billion infusion into the plans in 2015 under House Bill 119.
So I want to point this out. I want to slow down here for a minute because it's when we went and put that money in 2015, as referenced earlier, there's the $1 billion and the $2 billion, one for PERS and two for TERS. It dropped our liability, but if we look down our payment schedule relative to where we were previous to that, we've seen a substantial decline. And if you look at the last several years, it's really dropped off. And we could work with different amortization schedules and do all kinds of fancy mathematics, but I think that rubber hits the road on your unfunded liability dollar amount. And if that unfunded liability dollar amount isn't moving to be eliminated, we need to review our policy, what we're doing, and recognize that. Just like we recognize the overfunded health care, which is a positive in a lot of respects. But this will come in the operating budget discussion this year, what we want to put in the retirement system. And I think the governor dropped it maybe $25 million or some number from the ARM board. We'll have the ARM board. They made a presentation on that. They just delivered it to the office here a few minutes ago. But it's far too extensive and complicated just to slip in right before a meeting. We need to have a separate, I think, if the members want, we need to have a separate presentation and discussion on that, what we want to do, or what we'd like to recommend to the administration they approve, because we recognize we can appropriate and the governor could veto. So it is a concern that we're, but you can look at these columns here, add these numbers yourself, and compare it to the the unfunded liability and see the point I'm trying to make as far as the additional dollars we're spending. I don't think we're getting as much bang for our buck, or we need to do more dollars to get a bang for our buck. Go ahead and continue.
So slide 14 is showing the additional state contributions. What am I doing? So slide 14 is showing the additional state contributions projected from 2027 through to 2039. This is based on a scenario of an amortization that is yet to be finalized, and our actuaries are still working on it, but it runs with the assumption and the goal for PERS and TERS to be 100% funded by 2039.
So can you help me with the additional contributions? Because there's the state, and then there's other non-state entities that are in our retirement system. So what definition of additional contributions did you use to create this chart?
To the chair, the next couple of slides enlarge this, but the additional state contributions here, we're talking about the appropriation by the states from the general fund towards the past service cost. But the next slides do talk to that a little more.
Okay.
So the next two slides here, 15 and 16, they expand on the projections, which I've just shown on slide 14. This shows the projections for the additional state contribution alongside the contributions from non-state employers and the state as an employer for the past service costs. And for these, we use the same amortization scenario as slide 14.
So let's define at this first column so I'm clear, because the numbers get confusing. The non-state employers, City of Anchorage, City of Ketchikan, City of Juneau, there's some hospitals, there's all kinds of entities in this system that are non-state employees. This $2.5 billion, that is additional funding needed to retire the unfunded liability, correct? That's not your ongoing normal cost?
To the chair, you're correct. This is not the normal cost. This is all towards the past service cost.
Okay. So can you define those two terms so I don't get them backwards or I don't misunderstand what they are?
To the chair, let me try. The normal cost is funding the current pensions as they are, and the past service cost is generally towards the unfunded liability to essentially catch up. But if you want a more coherent explanation, I do have David Kirshner from Gallagher.
That's fine. We don't need the actuary to do this. What we're trying to do is make sure the folks at home follow what we're talking about. So the normal service cost is the cost to the employer every year for that year's benefits accumulated. And in a perfect world, if there was no unfunded liability, there'd be no past service cost. So the past service cost is something that materializes when the forward projections become inaccurate for whatever reason. Performance or healthcare changes, whatever. So what I'm looking at here is $2.5 billion from now to 2039, or you can take any given year, FY27, of $182 million. Those costs are costs that are capped at City Hall at 22% of the aggregate payroll. The state picks up anything above that. So if the cost was 27%, the state would pick up the additional 5 from 22 to 27. So they're capped at 22. So that $182 million, all the assemblies and town councils have to put that in their budget every single year and pay that liability. And the concern I have is no one talks about it in any of our communities that I know of. And we don't talk about it much. We put the cost of the pension in our operating budget every year. When we're talking about it a little bit today, that maybe we should be paying more, right, to get the liability down. But it's not, we discussed here a little bit, but it's very rarely ever mentioned. So you can take your aggregate payroll at any community, Juneau, for instance, or pick your town. I'm just because we're sitting in Juneau or Sitka, whatever. They're all the same. The aggregate payroll, roughly about 13% of the aggregate payroll is going to the unfunded liability, and that's passed on to every property taxpayer or sales taxpayer. Somebody's got to pay City Hall. So this is a significant amount of money, $2.5 billion. And then the state, as the employer, we can't avoid that. We should have that bifurcated out, everything above 22, that 5% spread, so we can look at that. But I guess that would be your additional state contribution. So that's kind of in a nutshell, I think, what we're looking at here. Is that correct?
To the chair, that is correct. Yeah.
Okay. It's my understanding. We'll go to the next page. It's a little bit different for those watching at home, but...
So to the chair, yeah, we're on slide 16. This is showing a similar story with TERS, but we don't have the breakout of status employer versus non-state employers in the case of TERS.
Okay, but TERS is somewhat different than PERS because TERS is basically our schools, and all of the past service cost at TERS has been absorbed by the state. And we did that 20 years ago because we end up paying for education anyway. And we would just have to fund it through the school funding mechanism. So we just kept them at the normal service cost, and the state picks up the balance. But it's, you know, it's still significant. So that's why there's a difference between PERS and TERS and how it's handled. We're under an obligation by the Constitution for education. We're not under an obligation by the Constitution to pay City Hall's payroll. They are. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There may be a couple of other factors that have us helping City Hall, but I wanted to ask about the previous slide and this slide together. Which amortization method do these slides have us using? Is it 15 years, it's 25-year, and do they assume that the ARM board is going to leave the earnings expectation, the target for our investors, alone? Or does it assume they're going to keep moving it down?
To the chair, to Senator Keel, I want to again stress this is a scenario. That is still to be approved by the ARM board, and it is of a 15-year layered amortization to have us fully funded by 2039. Regarding the future of that, I think I'd have to refer either to the ARM board or we could speak to our actuary.
What was the second question?
There were two, Mr. Chairman. The first, I think, was about the amortization method. Oh, that was the other one. Do these two charts assume that the earnings expectation is going to stay where it is now, 7.25, or are we going to keep moving our earnings target down, which the ARM board has been doing over the years?
Okay. Do you want to try to get him to answer that? Because that's going to come as a future presentation when we get into the amortization. It's about the slide deck's probably 20 pages, 25 pages. We're going to go into that in greater detail, but do you want how?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, be good to know just which assumptions cooked into these two slides.
I think they said 15-year, correct?
To the chair, that is correct.
Yeah, 15-year. So we'll be having these run at 25. So we can have that policy discussion here at the table and make a recommendation. Does that satisfy your question?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, that's very helpful on the first part. And then, you know, the other is sticking with 7.25. When we look back at those earlier slides, every time the return expectation goes down, the unfunded moves up or sometimes in a great market year fails to move down. I'm not suggesting that we should have stuck at 8.25. but it's a source of instability and it's a source of some of the difficulty in getting this paid off. So I just want to make sure I know which assumptions are cooked into these slides.
Mr. David Kirshner, I think you're online. Maybe you can help with that. It sounds like a part of a question to the actuary and part of a question to the asset managers, but for their projection. But Mr. Kirshner, if you can identify yourself and tell us what goodness you have.
Good morning, David Kirshner, actuary from Gallagher. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, so I think the question was these projections on slides 15 and 16, what assumptions are being used, particularly the investment return. These assume that the current 7.25% assumption will continue unchanged into the future. As we consider not just that assumption, but all of the current assumptions that have been used since the 2022 valuations are projected to continue. We're in the process of updating the assumptions as required by Alaska statutes for the four-year experience study. So it's possible that the ARM board will adopt different assumptions beginning with the 2026 valuations. But these figures that you're looking at here are based on current assumptions continuing in all future years.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, go ahead and continue.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was there additional questions for me?
Nope. That's it. You're off the hook for now. We'll see if there's other ones later. But you'll be, I'm sure you'll be back in to help us when we get into the 15-year, 20-year amortization to make sure we understand the policy recommendations that are in front of us to make make our own recommendation. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So now we're moving to slide 17, and we also move our attention to the funding level projections for the healthcare funds. This shows the actuarial projections of the funded level of healthcare trusts projected over the next 14 years with normal cost contributed and without normal cost contributed. Slide 18. The purpose of this slide is to demonstrate the difference in required additional state contributions and state as employer contributions with the inclusion and omission of the health plan normal cost. The difference is $63.8 billion over both systems. In recent years, healthcare normal cost is set at zero, influenced by the health plans being overfunded. Slide 19. This shows the FY27 contribution rates for the defined benefit plans and how they're calculated to arrive at the total actuarial required contributions employer and employee. What we do, we take the various employer rates, the peace and fire officer, all other employees, and terrorist employees, and then we take the employer rates, which are capped by statute at 22% for PERS and 12.56% for TERS, plus the additional state contributions, which include DCR contribution of 5.5% for PERS and 20.58% for TERS.
And if we didn't pay that 5.55, who would pay it?
To the chair, can I pass that to David Kirshner for an eloquent answer?
I think the answer is nobody would pay it if their cities are capped at 22% and we don't pay it. It's not a trick question. I'm not throwing quick or trick questions at you. I'm just trying to make sure that the public understands what we're looking at here, because the meetings are for them more so than us. So the and I was using earlier a 5% is rounding it off by memory, but that's that additional contribution at City Hall. And then the holding this TERS at 12.56 was the normal cost 20 years ago, if I recall, when we set that. And the state picks up everything over the top of it for all the teachers' retirement system. Okay, go ahead and continue.
So slide 20 shows the FY27 defined contribution plan. The tier four rates, 8% of gross is paid by the employee with an employer match of 5% for PERS and 7% for TERS. All the employer contribution rates are added, and the difference between that and the PERS and TERS statutory rates goes towards the defined benefit plan's unfunded liability. So slide 21, this shows the difference between the statutory rates for PERS and TERS and the actuarially determined rate historically. The spread between the blue and the orange lines is the portion covered by additional state contributions. So slide 22, this shows the projected benefit recipients.
Up there and go back to 21. I think it'd be nice if we had you add to this chart, if you could, the dollar amounts on it, because we're dealing with percentages here. But if we look at the percentages of the retirement system, we wouldn't recognize that our liability is stuck, right? Because the percentages all look good, but the dollars are what makes the table run. So that would be helpful. And they're previous in your previous slide, but it'd be nice if they're on one slide. Makes it much more, I think, effective to show the issue between the percentage being paid and the actual dollar movement in that unfunded liability.
To the chair, we can certainly arrange that. So slide 22, this shows the projected benefit recipients up until 2053. As more people retire, the pension recipients are forecasted to rise to a peak for PERS in 2030 and TERS in 2031. As we know, all employees have joined the defined contribution system since 2006, so naturally the defined benefit recipients will become less in number. Slide 23, this shows a similar story to the prior slide, but in a monetary way and relating to benefit payments. TERS will peak with 686 million benefit payments in 2033 and PERS with 1.5 billion in 2038. Gradually, of course, recipient dollars will reduce to near zero for the end of this century.
That's how many years from now?
To the chair, the graph, it takes us to the end of the century.
Right. 75 years.
Yes.
And I'd like to remind the committee that the conversation we had here several years ago when the last Civil War widow passed away and the end of the Civil War pension checks. That was probably maybe a decade ago. When was that conversation here, Senator Hoffman? About a decade ago. So there won't be anybody at this table that'll be here to see if that's how accurate this projection is. Anyway, it was shocking to us at the time that the pension lasted that long, or the Civil War pension.
So for the next three slides, I'm going to hand over to Chris Murray, our acting chief health officer, who's hopefully on the line.
Okay.
Over to you, Chris.
Chris Murray, if you could come on the line, walk us through next couple slides, I guess.
Certainly. Good morning. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. For the record, Chris Murray, I am the acting deputy director of health and chief health official for the Alaska Division of Retirement and Benefits. These next few slides are related to the Alaska Care Employer Group Waiver Plan. There's been significant discussion this morning about how the health care funds are overfunded, and we wanted to focus a little bit about this particular plan. We call it EGWP, because it is the primary reason for the overfunding status, or the overfunded status of the health care assets. So an employer group waiver plan, or an EGWP, is basically a group Medicare Part D prescription drug plan. So just like anyone who is Medicare eligible can go out and purchase their own Medicare Part D prescription drug plan, This is one that is purchased by an employer group. It's open to any employer group, public and private, and pretty much anyone, you know, any group payer could go out and purchase one if they wanted to. When this was implemented back in 2018, you'll notice this third bullet, in one fell swoop, it reduced liabilities in this health care, and these are prescription-specific, by nearly $1 billion. You can see that figure down there, $959 million, which, of course, resulted in the lower projected liabilities, lower projected contribution rates, and additional state contributions as well, and is the primary reason for the overfunded status of the health care trust at this time. Slide 25. So the employer group waiver plan, or the EGWP, essentially it's administered by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and essentially the way this works is they provide direct subsidies to the ElastiCare plan that help offset the liabilities. And this chart right here shows the subsidies that have been funneled through to the ElastiCare plans. A couple that I'd just like to focus on briefly. Is a direct subsidy, so that is a monthly payment that comes to the ElastiCare plans. You'll notice that in 2021, 2022, and 2023, those were negative subsidies, but in 2024 and 2025, they increased significantly. That is a direct result of the Inflation Reduction Act. Essentially, what CMS did is they restructured the formula of subsidies. And and you'll notice that the catastrophic reinsurance did essentially the opposite. And so what CMS has done is they have basically put the management of high-cost drugs more onto payers and onto plans. So they've, you know, brought up the direct subsidy. That is money that we can count on. But the catastrophic reinsurance, that is, money that basically kicks in at a certain point. And at this point in time, the federal government is responsible for less of that than we are. But it has certainly worked out in our favor. As you can see, the total subsidies have increased over the years. Now, this is, dynamic, and the formulas are done year by year. And it is never a guarantee that we will get any particular amount in a given year. But as you can see, these have continued to go up. And I can say that, you know, they've already made the decisions for 2026, and that the direct subsidy went up in 2026. So, we can have those numbers a little bit later, but, it is going to continue to go up. But, once again, this is never guaranteed. This is one of the potential risks that we have, is that these subsidies could go away, or they could change the formula again, which could negatively impact the health of the healthcare trust. And then slide 26. We just put this slide in here to ensure that everyone sees this is the healthcare cost trends. And as you can see, the take-home message here is that, they're not going down. Healthcare is expensive. It's very expensive in the state of Alaska. And, we do not expect these to go down. One thing that I do want to note is the distinction between medical pre-65 and medical post-65. And the reason for that distinction is that pre-65, the plan takes care of the majority of those healthcare costs, whereas when a member becomes Medicare age eligible, the plan is statutorily required to pay supplemental to Medicare. And so Medicare covers a lion's share of the cost of medical care after 65. And then you'll also notice that the RX or prescription plans and the EGWP plan, these early projections in 2026 and 2027, 8.5 and 8.2, they do decrease some. But a lot of that, initial higher projections here is due to GLP-1 usage for weight loss. We are seeing significantly higher prescription drug prices in the past couple of years due to that. It will, we do expect it will gradually go down. But as you can see, there is none of this that, it never goes down significantly. Healthcare costs just keep going up and up.
And these projections, Mr. Murray are pretty accurate, or is there a cloudy Ouija board on health care?
To the chair, I am not an actuary, but I spend a lot of time with them. I can tell you that in recent years, our healthcare costs have been trending between 5 and 7%. That's been in the past 5 years since I've been tracking this. And so, you know, I don't see any reason why these would not be accurate. But as we all know, no one has a crystal ball, and you know, we cannot say specifically what will happen. But you know, I believe that these are certainly following past trends, and I see no reason why they would not continue as such.
Mr. Kirshner, could you help us with that? Because these are significantly higher than the targeted inflation rate in the future, and I don't think they have a very good long-term record on forecasting health insurance escalations. Could you help us with that? Well, apparently you can't help us with that, so I guess we'll ask him some other time. At some point.
No, I'm here. My line's been unmuted. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead and help us with the rate of growth and
in
health care relative to inflation, relative to our past performance.
Yeah, well, first of all, I just want to say I am not a health care actuary. I'm a pension actuary by training. But in general, we used to set the trend rates, we have consistently used a model, a standardized model that's from the Society of Actuaries. But essentially, the theory is that medical trend rates cannot continue at their current levels because they'll eat up a larger and larger share of GDP. So the theory is that over time, healthcare cost increases will come down, approaching inflation. And you can see here we're using an ultimate rate of 4.5%, which is the which is a real GDP growth rate of 2% plus our 2.5% inflation. That gets us to a long-term trend increase of 4.5%. But as Chris said, there's no crystal ball. We as statutes require, we evaluate the healthcare costs, the actual costs that we're assuming, and these trend rate increases, we evaluate these annually. And as I mentioned, we're in the process of evaluating all of the assumptions for the upcoming experience study, and we'll probably be modifying these trend rates slightly, but the trend that you're seeing here grading down to 4.5% will not be changing.
Okay, thank you. We'll go on to, I guess, next slide.
So back on the record is Christopher Novell, Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Slide 24 shows the process timeline from valuation to the on-board resolution on additional state contributions to pay down the unfunded liability for PERS. In March this year, we're conducting our four-year experience study. The experience study is conducted every 4 years by statute. For PERS, it assesses the demographics, economic assumptions, and payroll assumptions.
Can you go a little bit more detail on this? This gets confusing, the delay, and one of the challenges we have with these type of retirement plans is the delay in the actuarial analysis and setting the rates. It's the calendar delay. On the first line, you've got 2024 valuation, and then go to the right-hand side, it's FY 2027 employer and additional state contribution. There's quite a gap there, so help us with that process.
To the chair, can I defer that to David Kirshner?
Mr. Kirshner, if you can come back on, I know you've explained this several times to the committee, I think every year, quite a few years. Help us with that again, please.
Sure. David Kirshner, actuary from Gallagher. So if we focus on the top one that's in the outline there, we in March of 2025, we reported to the ARM board to evaluate the June 30, 2024 valuation results. And that that is that time frame that when we receive data right around Labor Day of 2024, we do the valuations, we send everything to the Arm Board's review actuary, GRS. They review everything that we do, and then so that takes some time. So March of 2025, we prepared presented the valuation results to the Arm Board, and GRS reviewed them. Then in September of 2025, we prepared the contribution rates to be adopted for FY27. The starting in 2014, the process for setting contribution rates was set to what we call a two-year roll forward. So we take the results from the 2024 evaluation, we roll them forward 2 years, in this case to 6/30/26, which is the beginning of FY27, and then that's followed for all successive years. So we collect in that two-year roll forward, we collect actual assets that performed during that first year in 2025. Then we assume the assets will earn the expected rate, which is 7.25 for FY26, and that gets us to the beginning of FY27. And then the same process follows in each successive year. So the 2025 valuation results, which we are in the process of finalizing and discussing, we'll be discussing with the Arm Board next month, we will then use those results to set the FY28 contributions in September of 2026. So it's a two-year look forward or two-year look back between the valuation and the year for which the contributions are being set.
Okay. Thank you. It's just the delay is a challenge. But just what we have to work with. Okay, we'll go on. But next slide. Before you jump into this issue, thank you, Mr. Kirshner. Before you jump into this issue, I just want to back up a little bit and just make another comment I forgot to make when we were talking about the 10-year lag or the 10-year horizon and the liability being constant. In fact, we had the same number in the TERS. But the concern is, as an example, trying to put it in an understandable format, why I'm so concerned about, not the only one, a lot of us are concerned about the liability and getting it retired and getting it under control. If you were a young Alaskan and you were born in 1980, as an example, you were born in 1980, go to school 2005, you're coming into the workforce, you're 25 years old, we take a look at this unfunded liability issue start marching down that road with burdening the state and the non-state employers with this unfunded liability at 13% of their aggregate payroll. You're now in 2026. You're halfway through your working career. You've been burdened the whole time with this unfunded liability of errors and omissions and problems or wherever you want to pin on the old pension plan, but the benefits accumulated in the previous to 2006, mainly 70s, 80s, and 90s. You're halfway through your working career. Then on the table today, we go forward another 20 years on the unfunded liability. So your entire working career, if you were born in 1980 and you're an Alaskan, your entire working career, you've been burdened by this unfunded liability from your grandparents or your parents. So it is a significant issue when we get into this amortization schedule, 15, 25 years, whatever issue it is, to try to get a handle on this. It's just, you know, how an entire working career for somebody that started in 2005 is something that should not go unnoticed. And you can pick your year when you come into the system, but 13% of the aggregate payroll at City Hall is a lot of money and a lot of tax burden. So that's why we've been bringing this subject up, and we'll schedule that discussion with the ARM board over amortization, and we'll talk about it amongst ourselves and figure out what we want to do. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. To the chair, I think it would be good for me at least, maybe others, to see the set of risks that were realized that got us to that underfunded position. It's not just the, I know it's often said that, well, the actuarials messed up and gave us bad advice and we didn't fund adequately, but I believe there was probably a stack of realized risks, whether it was investment performance, the timing of that performance relative to the plan experience, and other elements that help feed into all of that. So if we have a future discussion, I think that would be a good area to talk about.
We can dig up old skeletons later on. But there's a multitude of issues, right? So we can look at that later. But, yeah, it's a problem. But anyway, let's go on to the current last year's problem that I think we've got resolved. Is that correct?
To the chair, yes.
Okay, good. So tell us the wonders that you did to fix this. That'd be good.
Okay, so it was November the 4th, 2024. The Division of Retirement and Benefits was informed by the Office of Information Technology of some unusual activity that was happening on the division's servers. So consequently, access to the state network and servers was suspended so we could have an investigation. It's important to note that from that investigation, we found out that no data from the division was accessed or breached. No information leaks, but given the time required to restore and rebuild the servers coupled with the ongoing initiative to migrate the division's programs and applications to the cloud, it was decided to complete this migration process. During this migration process, the e-reporting for payroll application employers used to submit contributions to the system failed. An additional programming was needed for it to successfully function. February the 6th, going forward to there, e-reporting was back online, but there was the expected backlog. To get past this, active payroll used a three-phased approach, allowing payroll reports from our employers over a free stage, so they didn't overwhelm the system at once. On April 30th, 2025, deadlines were provided for employers to report all outstanding payrolls, and the ultimate deadline was May 30th, and this was considered adequate time for all employers to get caught up. Following discussions with the division, the Department of Law, OMB, and the legislature, it was agreed that neither participants nor employers could be held responsible for the lost earnings due to the system outage, and as a result, an appropriation of $2.7 million was requested from and approved by the legislature to compensate participants for the lost investment earnings, and those funds became available for disbursement on June 5th, 2025. Between June 17 and July 21st, 2025, the make-whole payments were posted to the members' accounts.
Mr. Chairman.
So,
okay. Before we go on to that slide, Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. If we could go back to the previous slide, I think it might be worthwhile just to let Alaskans listening at home know what that unusual activity was, right, that started that. That's sort of a clinical term, and it's probably worth telling Alaskans, right, but this wasn't a glitch in your software. This was outside thieves trying to break in and steal either data or money, right? And my understanding is that the division did the responsible thing and locked it down before anything went missing. Am I understanding the origin of this right?
To the chair, yes, bad faith actors try to access our systems. And what was the second part of your question, I believe?
But, Mr. Chairman, credit where it's due. I think the division took good advice from information technology, and they locked down this system, mm-hmm. Which, of course, had these consequences we're dealing with, but my understanding is it was locked down before anybody's data was stolen and before anybody's money was stolen. Yes?
To the chair, that's correct. Yeah. Okay. Through the chair.
If I may. Thank you. So, kudos. It's well done, done right, and now we have cleanup to deal with. So as we look through the cleanup then, I think maybe what did this mean to those other employers, the city hall, the school district, the other folks, in terms of their obligation to make their payments every payroll? Because that sort of was implied, but we never said what's the system for? What did they have trouble doing?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, of course they didn't have an online system to report, but we didn't actually wait till it was back online. Our active payroll team worked with the employers to do it in a manual process because our team had access to e-reporting within the state, so they sent us spreadsheets so we could enter for them and they could reconcile and back and forth. So we started that right away. And, of course, when it was up and running on February the 6th, then they could report through the system again. But, of course, there was the backlog, and we didn't want them all reporting at once. And we strategized with, I think it was employer size to process that, so the system wasn't overwhelmed. So those were the things we did, and it wasn't a case of just waiting. We weren't sitting on our hands until the systems were up and running. We started work right away.
Okay, thanks. So thank you. So that was how we prioritized the system so that employers could put money into the retirement accounts that had to be put in with every payroll. Right? That's what we're talking about here?
To the chair. To Senator Keel, that's correct.
Thank you. So then, to then drill down maybe a little bit more into the specifics on the slide, there's a reference in here to how difficult it was to manually process those and how there were reports that by May were submitted timely but not processed. When did we finish processing the last of those reports that came in timely but just took time to get in?
To the chair, the 99% of the reports were in by May for us to process. So when I say 99% of employers had reported by May 30th.
Okay.
Go ahead. Follow up.
Just to make sure I understand, 99% of employers had all their reports in to DRB by May 30th, or DRB had all those reports processed, handled, the money went where it was supposed to go, everything was hunky-dory?
To the chair, the reports were all in by May 30. After that, there was the calculation effort to ensure that all the members were made whole, which I'm going to speak to a little bit on the next slide.
And so just the last one, if I may.
Sure.
So then those calculations, when was Division of Retirement Benefits done with getting all those reports calculated and in?
To the chair, to Senator Keogh, are you asking when did the calculations for the loss of earnings, when they were made, or just the actual payrolls?
The latter, please.
The latter. Oh, so that would have been May. May 30th, they would have been all been in.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Next page.
So the last page is showing some statistics relating to this. As you can see, the amount appropriated was $2.7 million. We calculated this using the Voluntary Fiduciary Correction Program calculator provided by the U.S. Department of Labor, or rather our Empower Retirement did that. And from there we calculated the loss of earnings to make our members whole. The total amount paid out was $1.3 million. As you can see, the breakout there of PERS 692, 1,000 TERS 552 and SBS 65. That left a remaining balance of 1.4 million to be returned to the state. The last statistics are total participants paid, 23,996. The highest amount paid out was 368.90, and someone received a quarter of a cent. The average paid out or was $54.58 or $46.98, depending if it's mean or medium calculation.
So the guy that, or the gal that got 0.24 of 1 cent, did you round that up, or how did you do that in his, on their account?
To the chair.
Did you give him a whole penny, or did you?
To the chair, I believe that was, I don't know. I know there were seven individuals that were paid less than a penny.
So let's just move on, because that won't bankrupt us. The $6 billion in liability might have a bigger impact, but.
To the chair, that's all I've got for that. Oh, no, I don't have one more slide. I do apologize. This slide is relating to the collaboration and communication, and all these individuals worked very hard towards getting us, getting our members made whole. And the fact that they worked so hard and so diligently and efficiently is the reason we're returning 1.4 million back to the state.
It was an unfortunate incident that we had this attempted breach of our system, but I think we, you know, here at the table last year, we were, inclined just to make everybody whole and move on, fix the system. That, you know, things happen once in a while. But I do have a request for the committee. I'd like to know that when we deal with our unfunded liability, the non-state employers, if you could get back to us on who's in arrears of paying their unfunded liability to the state. Last year we had that report. I think it needs to be updated. There's several entities that, and how long they're in arrears. At some point, we have to have a discussion on how we're going to deal with that. And then if how many that are possibly in arrears but have come to an agreement on a catch-up. So they're technically not in arrears by some definition, but they're still backed up in their payment. We'd like to know those also, so we see the full extent of it.
To the chair, we can do that.
Yeah, just an update of last year's data set, frankly.
And if no one has any more questions, that concludes my presentation, our presentation.
Okay, any other questions for the department? Yeah, I'd like to thank the department for putting this together, and again, thank them for their working hard and Department of Admin to deal with our retirement plan. It affects a lot of people around the state, both state and non-state employers. So thank you for coming in, and we'll schedule that upcoming ARM board discussion with the amortization presentation that was put forth today. There's no time for today to put that on the table, and I think it'd be good also to have it as a separate discussion, because it's a policy potential disagreement between the legislature and executive branch and or the ARM board. We could have one opinion or three opinions, but we need to look at it as the policymakers and give our recommendations to the ARM board and the administration. With that, that'll conclude today's meeting. This afternoon, 1:30, the much anticipated House Bill 78, Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Option. There's a new bill, not a new bill, but a new retirement structure that'll be put on the table today. 1:30, House Bill 78 for an introductory hearing. Thank you very much. We are adjourned at 10:20 a.m. We're adjourned.